grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast, coming to you in a pre-recorded fashion because, yes, once again, folks, I am on the road. How about that? After so long of having no shows, no live production, things like that, it's not that there's a windfall of live production going on in the world, but there is definitely a return. So it's nice to see a small modicum of normalcy coming back to the world. Of course, there are still horrible things going on across the globe. We'll be getting into some of that in some of our news of the week here in just a minute. Our guest this evening, I am so, so proud to bring back the amazing researcher and author, Mary Joyce. Last time we had her on, we had a bombshell great episode that actually charted fantastically. One of my favorite things to do is follow the evolution of episodes in our stats and how they fare over 30, 60, 90 days. And Mary Joyce's last episode with us about underground military bases was one that just continuously charted on an upward course of numbers until it just no longer appeared in the charts because it had gone so many days since she was on that the metrics stopped following that as a chartable. And it was then that I was like, man, I've got to get her back on. Whenever she was on, we talked a little bit about the Cherokee Little People. And I really, really wanted to have her on to talk about that piece of American folklore and mythology with the Cherokee Indians. So she is on today to talk about that. Her website, of course, is skyshipsovercashers.com. Make sure to stop on by and check that out. We'll be getting into so much with Mary tonight about things like that. Make sure to stop on by while you're online checking out skyshipsovercashers.com. Make sure to stop on by Facebook and visit the Dudes and Beer group. Curious Realm, formerly Dudes and Beer, is where you will find us. We are, of course, going through that rebrand come December. We will officially be the Curious Realm, and I cannot wait to grow larger, bigger, better, faster. We have the technology. We can do it, people. We had a great episode last week with Mike Turber and Jack Sarfati. Thank you so much for our good friend Mike Turber for literally randomly surprising me on air. Like, oh, yeah, I got this audio clip. And then he brings Jack Sarfati on my show to talk about all kinds of wild stuff. It was great talking about the technology that exists behind Tic Tac, things like that. Some of the news of the week this week coming to you from our Dudes and Beer Curious Realm group. UFOs and Nukes Press Conference 2021, organized by Robert Salas. That was shared by Kenneth Dudley today on there. From Smithsonian Mag, our archaeologists discovered 2,550-year-old carving of the last king of Babylon. Out of NBC News, the officer who shot Ashley Babbitt speaks after months of hiding and says he saved countless lives. Out of fizz.org, discovery of the fastest ever magnetic wave propagation proved by science. France24.com reporting a visually impaired Paralympian hit by self-driving bus. If that's not a headline of headlines, I don't know what is. California defies doom with number one U.S. economy. That coming out of Bloomberg this week. And an amazing video from the New York Post appears to show Taliban fighters taking joyrides in U.S. Black Hawk helicopters. That once again is just some of the news of the week that we bring you there on the Dudes and Beer group on Facebook. Make sure to stop on by, join Curious Realm, formerly Dudes and Beer, follow the page for all the episode and guest promotions that we put out, all that good stuff. While you are online checking everything out, make sure to stop on by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is the creator of some of the best CBD product out there, folks. A few years ago, I was recommended CBD by my doctor for my travel anxiety. I, of course, take meds for my anxiety, things like that. But she was like, I think this would be a great supplemental for you. I've heard great, great response from other doctors. And it was shortly after that that I found Christopher Lynch at a literal farmer's market here in Austin, Texas. He is the owner and founder of True Hemp Science and also the creator. He uses a 100% spigeric process using every part of the plant, the bud, the leaf, the stem, everything, total alchemical process to create what I have found to be some of the most amazing CBD product out there. You can actively taste terpenes. It doesn't just taste like oil in your mouth. And it is quite literally some of the most amazing product I have found countrywide throughout dispensaries. Stop on by, check it out. TrueHemScience.com is the website. Dude7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. And get two free 25 milligram edibles, either cookie or brownie, on your way out the door. Once again, that website is truehemscience.com. The code that you want to use on your way out the door is dude7 for 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and two free 25 milligram edibles. While you're online checking that out, make sure to stop on by and check out all the great stuff brought to you by this sponsor right here, Podcast Cadet. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. That's right, folks. Stop on by, check it out, PodcastCadet.com. Full disclosure, I am one of the founders of Podcast Cadet. The whole reason I helped found that company was to help people be able to brand their show, package it, find ways to monetize. Podcasting is such a nebulous industry, and it can be hard to navigate your way around those waters. So that is what we do at Podcast Cadet. What they do over at Skyship Over Cashers, though, is something entirely different. Welcome back to the show. How are you today, Miss Mary Joyce? Are you there? I think you're there.
I'm here.
There you are.
Sorry. There's this little mute button, and I had it off while you were doing your intro, and I had to turn it back on.
You know what's funny? I'll show you my dirty secret right here, because I'm a live AV technician. Sometimes we make love notes to ourselves.
Yes, I actually have
this. It lives right here in my eyesight, because I cannot tell you how many times I've hit every single button to go live places, but I didn't unmute my audio. It happens. It happens. Even us professionals who mash buttons for a living sometimes just miss that one that's so important.
And, well, we're good to go now.
Well, I want to thank you once again, because speaking about missing things that are important, I missed our record time last time and was complete, like, you can ask my wife, I was crushed inside, like, all day, Mary. It was one of those, like, man, I was really, really, really looking forward to that conversation. And I just totally whiffed that interview time. And it's not often that it happens to me, but it does happen. So I apologize to you publicly, and I want to thank you for taking the time to come back on and talk about your book, Cherokee Little People Were Real. Native American lore is, of course, some of is the oldest lore in our country, but it has some of the most fascinating stories. And when you start getting into the stories of the Cherokee Little People, it is really amazing. How did you come to start researching this to begin with?
I confess that I didn't know a thing about Cherokee Little People when I moved to North Carolina, and I live in the mountains of North Carolina, where we have lots of interesting things. You and I have already talked about the underground bases here. We also have Bigfoot. We have the Little People. We have lots of UFOs. There's plenty to keep you investigating because there's so many unusual things that happen here in these mountains. And when I moved here, I really started to hear these stories about these Cherokee Little People, and I thought they were just like Indian, almost like fairy tale stories they would tell around a campfire. And then I began to hear these stories more and more. And one day, this elderly man who was very, very well respected in this area told me, no, they were real. And when he was a young man right after World War II, he was involved in doing construction at Western Carolina University, which is, again, here in the mountains. And when they were so many times when they were digging what was supposed to be virgin land, they would find these little tunnels. And the tunnels were always roughly, let's say, 2 feet to 2.5 feet wide, about 3.5 feet tall. They were square cut, except they always had a rounded arch at the top, which, if you know anything about engineering, makes them more stable. And so, I had every reason to believe that he was telling me the truth. And he introduced me to other old timers. Most of them had worked on construction. They had, you know, operated the equipment. They had dug into, you know, virgin land all over this valley where the university is now. And they would always find these little tunnels. They also found little skeletons. And there was a professor who kept a small skull on his desk. And I guess it's a conversation piece. And one day, I believe it was a high school English teacher, picked it up and looked at it real closely and said, this is not a child's skull, which is what he said it was. She said, it has all its wisdom teeth. So those are the kind of things I began to hear. And after that, I spent most of my Saturdays for about a year around kitchen tables with these old timers who never would have talked to me if I had just gone and, you know, knocked on their door. But because one old timer led me to another old timer, I was able to get information I wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
It's interesting the way that works. I myself, my family comes from a very rural community in Louisiana. And especially in rural communities, it works that way so entirely. Once somebody trusts you with it, more people seem to come out of the woodwork, and it's interesting. Prime example, when I lived in Mamou, Louisiana, I took a great interest in accordion and found one gentleman who then introduced me to another gentleman, then introduced me to another gentleman. And it led to, like, this whole Cajun jam circle that happened two towns over in another parish, you know? But I would have never found that little subculture of people had that one person not realized that my interest was a genuine interest.
And this is another thing that, you know, fits in with the small community. nobody had recorded these stories. They weren't anywhere. And I thought they were unique enough that they needed to be saved. So that was the motivation for doing that book. And again, the title is Cherokee Little People Were Real, and it's available on Amazon if anybody else is interested in this kind of topic. Not only did I deal with these adult men who had worked on construction projects, many of these grew up in that area, and so they had gone to school at the oldest building on the campus, the McKee Building, when it had been a grade school and then a high school. And so they had stories about these little people and their tunnels way back from when they were children. And some of their childhood time periods would be the 30s and 40s. A number of those are popping into my head right now. The little boys used to think they were really smart, you know, to smoke. And so they would hide their cigarettes down where the janitor kept his equipment. And that was also where they accessed where these little tunnels were still in existence that ran out from the McKee Building. And they were too little to be brave enough to crawl into the tunnels, but they at least would dare each other to go and peek into them. And so it was interesting to get the stories from their childhood and then also from their adulthood. And one of the things that I found very fascinating, which I wouldn't have known if these men didn't have that breadth of experience, they remember climbing on what they called an old Indian mound, but it wasn't a typical Indian mound. There was a vertical hole or tubular hole that went straight down into the middle of it. And they later found that many of these tunnels came to this supposed Indian mound. The old timer said it wasn't an Indian mound. It was a pile of dirt from these tunnels being dug out.
So, wow. Interesting. And I mean, even right now, I've got an article up from another part of the country talking about the Cherokee stories in Northeast Oklahoma. I mean, these stories.
Because the Indians fled to Oklahoma during the Trail of Tears. Yeah. And there are stories that some of the little people went with some of those Cherokee.
Well, and that's what I love about this is the fact that it's a story that survived such an incredible tragedy and such an incredible loss of culture in and of itself. But yet still these stories survived and even survived amongst the Anglo settlers that were there. So let's start getting into some of the things that you discovered while researching this.
Okay, I want to start with something that fits with the title of your show, Dudes and Beer.
Okay.
And their moonshining went on in this area during the 30s. And I got to meet some of the old-timers who had gotten into moonshine, which was one of the few ways to survive at that time in this part of the country. And there were some moonshiners who said they found a pile of little, like child-sized bones when they were building their still, and it was up at the top of a mountain here, and they covered them up real quickly because they didn't want anybody to discover them or their moonshine still. And one of the old timers, he was 87 at the time, and he had already lost, he only had his peripheral vision. And so I went out into the woods down this old path that, you know, hardly looked like a path anymore. And we tried very hard to find remnants of that location. We didn't have any luck, but it certainly was an interesting time parading down through the wildest part of the mountains.
Even those guys, moonshiners, stuff like that, once again, it extraordinarily secretive most of the time. So for that story to have even survived with them is pretty incredible. Was anything ever found? Did anybody ever reveal where they may have originally found that pile of bones?
I was hoping to find them, or I was hoping somebody would. Never had success with that one. All we could do was find the old path, which if I hadn't had somebody, the blind leading the blind, really, but he was able to lead me down And you could see where this single lane road had been built, and you could see where shovels had been used to whack out part of the mountain so that a wagon could get by. So we were walking through some really old history.
Wow. Wow. And yeah, I mean, so often you do hear of the quote, deathbed confessions in situations like this, where somebody's like, yeah, you know, that story that you heard about, it's true. You know, I was there, but kind of sad that you didn't have that in this situation. Because what an incredible find that would be to actually be able to uncover what they found while they were carrying that out.
Well, I did find one piece of an actual artifact. And back in 1940, there was a horrific historic flood of the Tuckasegee River that runs through this area. And there was a five-year-old boy who found what he called a lead head. And it was oval shaped. It was about an inch and a quarter in length. It had like a leprechaun face on each side, and it had been washed out from, you know, I don't know, for ages of dirt that had, you know, washed away in this flood. And it was very heavy. It had the pointed ears like Spock. It had the elongated pointed nose like a leprechaun. And the features on each side of it were just slightly different, and it had a seam all around the edge. So whatever this was had been molded, and I have a picture of it in the book, so you don't have to use your imagination.
I've got it on screen.
There you go. There you go. And you found that on, wow, very good. Anyhow, that's it, and that's the photo that I took so that we could have a picture of what it actually looked like. I thought that was a pretty interesting find. He did call it a lead head because it was so heavy. Now, this kind of leads to another thing I learned when I was doing all this, was that there wasn't just one kind of little people. The traditional little person in this area, they call the Cherokee little people because they look like the Cherokee with the dark hair, except they're miniature people. Not dwarfs. They're not out of proportion. They're in proportion. That's what you normally think of. But when the Cherokee first moved here, they were very perplexed. They migrated from the Great Lakes region. And when they arrived, they found these little gardens, but they didn't see any people. Eventually, they saw these little people coming out from underneath the ground, getting the produce from their garden and taking it back under the ground. And they call them the moon people because they came out at night by the light of the moon. So there is another total different description. Those were described as having almost a blue tint to their skin and the larger eyes. And there was a third kind, and the Cherokee didn't, for some reason, like them at all. And they had red hair or red whiskers, and the Cherokee would try to kill them. Well, if you try to put these pieces together, you see this leprechaun and image on a stone or a piece of metal, and you wonder if that perhaps wasn't one of the ones that was known as the red-whiskered ones. Who knows?
Sure. If it was, you know, perhaps an amulet of protection or something that was given as a gift or token, because, of course, that was a regular practice in most cultures that had this kind of, be it little person or wild man of the woods, what have you. Typically, there would be a place where you would go and give offering to it for safe passage through the woods, things like that. So could it be that this token that y'all found, that was found near the river, rather, could be something along those lines, you know?
All we can do when you find things like that is speculate, because it was just a five-year-old who found it. When I learned about it and got to see it, the man was in his 70s, and he was not about to part with his little find that he found as a five-year-old.
So, oh, I'll bet.
It was, you know, so I hope someday it gets into public viewing. You know, I hate to have things like this just be, you know, hidden away in somebody's bedroom.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that's just it. You find out so often that is the case, and that something that was found at one point has been lost. Even the whole concept of giants in America and the skeletons that were found and put away by the Smithsonian that are just now lost, you know. And
let me branch off on that a little bit. At Western Carolina University, I got to meet a number of people who graduated from the anthropology department. And they told me that not only did they have the little skeletons and that little skull in storage in their forensic area, or whatever they called it, they also had two giant skeletons, and they had six toes. Well, as a number of years go by, and I'm at my my downtown office, which is Dunkin' Donuts, and overheard a conversation. And this another person who was with the anthropology department said that those skeletons had all been recently shipped off to the Smithsonian. And I just wanted to groan, because there are now books out, and I'm sure you're at least somewhat aware of them, where things go to the Smithsonian like giant skeletons never to be seen again.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what's happened to some of these things that I've learned about.
Well, yeah, and it's odd. It's almost like the Smithsonian has become like the warehouse at the end of Indiana Jones.
Yes.
Where things are just going to go and be examined by top men. Top men. And then they're just never heard from again.
Well, we can only speculate. It seems like if we start to acknowledge little people and acknowledge giants, that it totally upsets traditional history as we know it. That seems to bother a lot of people. And so some people think maybe that's the whole motivation for not wanting to let some of this stuff out.
Well, and that's what's funny, though, Mary, that we talk about on this show all the time, is the, quote, religion of science. And I am more prone to say that there are little people, because like just about all of the Native American tribes in America and the greater North Americas, that goes all the way into Canada, Nova Scotia, just about all of them have a legend of it.
Right. And there's little people stories from around the world.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. And I have been able to collect a number of stories since I did this book, because what happened was, when I did the book, there were so many people who weren't about to tell me their stories because, quote, the white people have always tended to laugh at the Indians when they would talk about things like Cherokee little people.
Yeah.
So the Indians learned just not to talk about them. Once I came out with the book and people found out I wasn't going to laugh at them, I began to hear stories about little people still living in the mountains around here. And that really doesn't surprise me, because I absolutely have seen very convincing evidence of Bigfoot in this area. Well, if something as big as a Bigfoot can hide out around here and most people never see it, the little people would have a much easier chance of staying out of sight.
Yeah, yeah, precisely, especially if they're burrowers and diggers and making tunnels. And once again, these things have been reported in numerous newspapers that they were found, you
right.
know.
I know you're interested in lots of archaeology and past information. We also have a rock here. It's called Judicola Rock. It's roughly 16 feet by 11 feet, and it looks like a big slab, flat slab, that's at a slight angle, sort of like an easel. And it's covered with petroglyphs. It's the largest petroglyph in Western North Carolina, or in North Carolina, and one of the largest in the whole southeastern part of the United States. And nobody's been able to figure it out. Many people have guessed, and I would tend to lean this way, that since the Cherokee can't make sense of it, that maybe the little people were the ones responsible for those petroglyphs.
Wow. That would be a very interesting way to explain that, because, of course, the stories of them go back to about the same time everything else. So Yeah, that would be really interesting to see how that pans out. What other stories did you come across regarding the little people during your research? How many Native Americans were willing to speak with you about these legends and tales?
Actually, well, afterwards, and I haven't even really put that together in an organized fashion. I've posted some of the stories on the website that I have, mm-hmm. but not in book form, but there's, you know, a growing collection of them. But what was interesting, what readers might find interesting about the book, is first of all, it's like the firsthand stories. It's the word for word accounts from these men who made many of these finds. And they're like stories. For example, one guy, he would walk to school every day and he would go to this building called the McKee Building, which I mentioned earlier, which had been a grade school and then a high school and now is part of the university. And he would stop and talk to this man who plowed the fields there with two horses, you know. And he remembered, several occasions where the farmer expressed concern that he always worried that one of those tunnels would give way and his horses would break a leg. So that's just another interesting way of supporting this idea that there was a whole network of these tunnels that went every which way. Another thing that I found just terribly ironic is that the anthropology department is in the basement of the McKee Building. This is interesting because on the other side of the basement supporting wall, there still exist these tunnels. So nobody can see them now. But on the one side, you have an anthropology department. On the other side, you have this incredible, I don't know what you want to call it, ancient tunnel. And if I had been in charge, which I'm not in charge of much of anything, but I would have put in a screen window so people could have seen that. I would have promoted that. It would have been a wonderful basis for an archaeology department. I don't know why they didn't capitalize on it. And one of the things that I was very, very disappointed with the university was that this is an educational institution where you're supposed to be trying to learn new things. And they seem to be more concerned about building new buildings. They didn't want their building projects to be slowed down or stopped. And one of the men, you know, who had been a student there, told me that he and some of his buddies had been down by the creek that runs through the university, and the head of security came by with a box that was a little bit bigger than a shoebox, and they got into a conversation with him. And he just said it was one of the little people skeletons from where they were doing construction, and he was taking it to rebury it on an ATV trail because they didn't want to have to stop their project. So here's an educational institution that was sitting on a gold mine and never took advantage of it. All they could think about was building more buildings.
Well, yeah, finishing the project at hand and making sure that that was done so that, I guess, grants could move forward, things like that. The grease that greases those cogs in the university and educational system. And even with taking that into consideration, what would the Native Americans in the area have thought about that? Because some of their legends regarding the little people, some of their caveats, you know, like regarding following little people or even perhaps interacting with them one-on-one, like most of that was pretty forbidden, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the legal things are. I think they've become much more severe in enforcing them now.
Oh, sure.
Back when they were first, you know, mowing down or shoveling down the mound with the hole in the top of it, they may not have been that strict about things. I really do not know. Mm. But I was telling you how the men had been boys and they used to play on that mound. And they said that the farmer kept quite a number of big logs that would be 6 to 8 inches in diameter in that hole to keep the cows from falling down into it.
Oh, wow.
So the book is a number of these kind of revelations or stories from people who experienced them as boys and then as men. And I have lots of photos and lots of location maps. I really wish that a really good anthropologist or archaeologist would take some of the information I put together and really dig deeper and see if they could find more. I certainly don't have the money or the expertise to pull that off on my own.
Well, and much like your book about the underground bases, the research that you've done into this, you have done such a great job cohering it together and bringing it together. As somebody who is not a professional anthropologist or anything in that right, Mary, just the research that you've done, combing through the stories, gathering the stories, bringing them together and putting at least the evidence at hand together, it's really fantastic, and the book is very well done in that right. What were some of once again the caveats? Because of course, some people want to explore these things, Mary, which I guess could be advisable, could probably, at least according to most Native American lore, be pretty ill-advisable, right?
I think a good archaeologist could use this as a roadmap, and I do have some location maps in there. And while they can't go digging, beneath the buildings that exist there now, there are still things, let's say, on the outskirts of the campus.
Sure.
That could be explored. One of the, I think he was the oldest or the second to the oldest man that I interviewed. And when he was a boy, which this is off the top of my head now, I think it would have been in the 20s, his father ran a mica mine, which would have been south of the campus. And he remembers that the miners came back real excited one day to their house and were telling their dad about finding this little tunnel. And when the miners for the mica were digging that, they ran into something perpendicular, and it was another little tunnel. And this was one of those ancient ones. So that stuck in his mind from the age of 6 or 7. And wow. Then he was involved with construction on the campus, and was one of the first ones to find some of the tunnels there.
Now, what do you? This is just, a morbid curiosity question, Mary. What do you think, through your research and hearing of stories, things like that, what do you think would happen if we were to run across this civilization in modern time? If we were to start literally following the rabbit holes, like once again, folks, if you go much like there. The images of the lead head that Mary was talking about, there are also numerous images of little hobbit holes, things like that, that are all over the place in state parks, on Native American land, where they say that these little people quite literally come from and come out of.
One of the things that I really want to emphasize is that people use that term little people loosely. And
yes,
some people are
seen
like little tiny fairy type people. I am not talking about that. I'm talking about little people that would be in the neighborhood of like 3 feet tall and perfectly proportioned.
Yes.
I get contacted occasionally by people who have stories of, the fairy realm and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing.
It's not like fairies or gnomes or leprechauns in Ireland. It's something entirely different.
Correct. And I don't know. I don't think that there's any city-sized communities that exist anymore, though there's every evidence that where Western Carolina University is today, that once was a city hub for the little people. And I have found evidence of that, you know, 5 and 10 miles away from that center. So it was truly a hub. I think now we have like the remnants of that culture. So you wouldn't find them in large numbers like I think they absolutely must have been at one time.
Interesting. And what were some of the dangers of running across these people? Were they utterly friendly anytime people came across them, or were there instances of, I guess, not necessarily malice on their part, but were there instances of conflagration between the little people and either Native Americans or settlers or any of that sort?
There has been interaction. In the book, I've got one story about a family that several of the people knew about, and they were a family of these little people, and they interacted with the regular community. The man's name was Toby, and he would drive a truck for somebody, but he was so small that he stood to drive the truck, and he would look out through the center of the steering wheel to see where he was going. So that gives you an idea of the person's size.
Wow.
And they said that, you know, the whole family was that way, and they had their furniture was little. So that would have been an example, a rather unusual example of interaction with little people. The stories that are more common is that the old timers on the reservation will make friends with the little people. Some of them will put out food for them. And the story goes, if they forget to put the food out, they'll start to hear pebbles being thrown on the roof as if to remind them, hey, where's the food?
Wow. Wow. And even here on the Mount Oglethorpe Foundation website, talking about the Cherokee legend, said sometimes their drums are heard in lonely places in the mountains, but it is not safe to follow it.
I sometimes wonder if the Cherokee parents use that as a way of keeping the kids under control. I really do not know.
Oh, sure.
But it's a very common story where the kids were told, don't go there. The little people will get you. I don't know. It may have been a invisible fence to keep the kids in tow. I have no idea.
Well, and hey.
I haven't heard any bad stories other than that.
When you come from a culture that might just be using drums to communicate, you know, it might not be a good idea to follow strange drums off in the distance that aren't from where your camp is. You know what
well,
I mean?
That's a good point. Very good point.
That's kind of like hopping in the white van that says candy on the side, kids.
this story is not in my book. It is one of the ones that I have begun to collect from people who have opened up with me since I did the book. And this one, I think, is just plain cute. The story comes from a young Cherokee woman. She was 29 when I met her, very shy. She never would have talked to me except we had a mutual friend, and the friend vouched for me, and so she was willing to talk to me. And her family had a place in a remote part of the Cherokee Reservation where they would keep a small trailer, and they would have their like family reunions or family gatherings there. And they would use the trailer, as a restroom and also a place where they could fix food. And she recalls that they often played hide and seek, the kids did. And she said one day she went to hide in the shower of this trailer. And when she pulled back the curtain, there was this little man just grinning at her. And she described him as looking like, I'm going to probably say it wrong, Mowgli from The Jungle Book.
Okay.
And, but he just had a big grin on his face. He was having fun with it. Of course, it freaked her. And she said she instantly ran to her daddy.
Wow. Wow. And, man, I remember, and you like to say, like, hey, that's the imagination of a child, you know. But at the same time, I have an experience from when I was about 4 years old that is the most, one of the most vivid memories in my life that still gives me chills to this day. So
I would love to hear this.
We lived in a little trailer house out in Crosby, Texas, and I just remember looking out. There was kind of a swing set in between our property and the neighbor's property, and we were very close with the neighbors. She used to watch over us. I used to help her gather her chicken eggs, things like that. And I remember looking out from the living room one day and seeing this shadowy figure out at the swing set beckoning to me.
That sounds like it might scare you to death, didn't it?
It was frightening, and like I said, I am 45 years old now. I know that we did not live in that trailer house past the time I was 3 and a half, 4. So for all I know, like, hey, that may be like some clip from a movie that I saw at 6 years old, but it is a memory that I have had in my brain since I was a kid that still to this day, like, I've got goosebumps right now even thinking about it. That was the feeling of chill that it sent through my bones at that age. So I don't discount things like that when I hear them from children.
Right. And of course, most of the stories that I've gotten are from adults with adult experiences, but, I just thought that was cute to pull back a curtain and see Mowgli from the Jungle Book in the shower. And that's actually a pretty good description because they have the straight dark hair and, you know, they're short like Mowgli, and I thought you gave a good description.
Well, and with that in mind, we've got you for a few more minutes. Let's start getting into what their description is, what their stature is. What should people, I don't necessarily invite everybody in the world to start going out and traipsing through national parks and digging or looking for things, but if they think that they may have a sighting, if they think that they may have had a sighting in their life, what should they be looking for?
You never find these kind of things if you're looking for them. It's that simple. They just kind of happen in your life. I was contacted recently by a man who's in his 70s now, and when he was probably in his teens or 20s, and he's a Cherokee man, he was bear hunting with a friend, and the weather got really, really bad, and, you know, thunder, lightning, and so they took cover in a cave for the night, and he was asleep, and his buddy woke him up and told him to be quiet and listen. And there were, I guess, at least two little Cherokee outside the cave talking. And what they said was like the old Cherokee language. They said that they could understand some of it, but not all of it, because the language has changed. And the next morning when they went out, because the ground was wet, they saw the little footprints, and, you know, they were small. So that's a story that I've heard recently. Because of this book, you know, somebody was able to share a story that they'd had for, you know, many, many years.
And that's what's great, is when you've been able to put something out, when you've been able to compile something and actively move people with it, Mary, and move them to action, move them to come forward with the story or experience that they've had. So kudos to you on that front.
You're kind to say so. Thank you.
Well, once again, before we let you go, I mean, I know that things have been wild over the last year, year and a half, conferences, things like that. But aside from Amazon and, of course, the Dudes and Beer store, where they can pick up Cherokee Little People Were Real, as well as your other books, Bigfoot Beyond the Footprints, Tangible Evidence of Jesus, as well as one of my favorites, Underground Military Bases Hidden in the North Carolina Mountains, as along with our store and Amazon. Tell everybody where they can go to find your work, where they can go to sign up for mailing lists, all that kind of good stuff.
You can find the website that I actively update usually once a week is called skyshipsovercashers.com. And if you just type in skyships over, you'll probably get it. Mm-hmm. Cashers is spelled like a cashier at the grocery store. And you've got the home page there. And up at the top, it says how to report a sighting. That's how you can get in touch with me. It's right beneath the search box, that one right there. And it just, you have my address and my email and, you know, anything else you might want to know. So that's the best way to contact me.
Absolutely. And once again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for all the time that you spend culling this research together and bringing it together, because it can, once again, these stories, especially when you're talking about small mountain communities, things like that, they are often so protected. They are often so hush-hush and in the background that it's hard to coax them out. So the fact that people are coming to you with them more and more, I think really is a telltale sign about the great work that you are doing over at Skyships.
And all those books are available through Amazon, like everything else.
Yeah.
It's like you can't, like, going through Amazon.
Absolutely. Well, once again, Mary, thank you so much for your time. Please do hold the line. Well, I guess not hold the line. We have a guest coming up after you. Coming up here in just a moment, everybody, right after this break, will be Mitchell Gerber. We will be talking about actual human organ harvesting going on in China and the UN effort to stop it. The actual cover-up that has happened and ensued, some of the most incredible, revealing conversation you'll ever hear, coming up with Mitchell Gerber right after this, folks. Well, hello again, everybody, and I would like to welcome back to our show Mitchell Gerber. Mitchell Gerber is an investigative journalist who has spent the last many years, almost 20 years of his life, trying to expose organ harvesting in China. Mitchell, welcome back to the show. How are you today, good friend?
It's good to see you, Chris. Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, man. This is one of the many causes that I think has kind of steeled Dudes and Beer and our upcoming Curious Realm entity, as far as mission. You know, there's a lot of things that we have as far as mission with this show, but shining a light in the darkness is the big one. And my God, the darkness that surrounds the topic of organ harvesting in China, Mitchell, is mind-numbing, is the only way to put it. Welcome back to the show. Let's get into the topic of Chinese state-sanctioned forced organ harvesting in China. Like, it's such a mouthful and such an unbelievable mouthful that, my God, man, is so absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, this is a new form of evil, Chris, that the world hasn't yet come to realize. It's extremely hard to get your head around it, wrap your head around it, and fathom that a superpower in the world today, China, that has the second largest military, the second largest economy, the largest population, they're controlling the United Nations, they're controlling the World Health Organization, they have big ties to the US, UK, and British parliaments and governments. They run pretty much Hollywood. They write, they control what goes in the scripts and what goes out of the scripts. And if you dare criticize them, you're going to be fired. You know, you're going to be taken care of. So this kind of red dragon, the red dragon that has got so much power, are basically sending hundreds and thousands of their innocent people, citizens, prisoners of conscience, to state-mandated hospitals, cutting out their organs while alive and selling their organs as the healthiest organs in the world, fueling a multi-billion-dollar business, and then burning the bodies and cremating the bodies to conceal the evidence.
Yeah, it's, like I said, a mouthful of absolutely heartbreaking and heart-wrenching topic. And I can understand, like, absolute trigger warning with this part of the episode, folks, because it's hard. It's hard to accept that this kind of inhumanity still exists in our day and age. It's hard enough to accept, Mitchell, that, man, we still deal with straight massacre of people to begin with, that we are still in this day and age dealing with that Holocaust concept of, hey, those people on the other side of the trees, we just need to get rid of them, you know, that utter tribal mentality. But when you marry that tribal mentality with something as brutal and horrifying as forced organ harvesting, where it's literally, hey, those people on the other side of the trees live an incredibly healthy lifestyle, and we should start selling them as body parts.
Well, I'd love to play the first clip for your audience. Sure. To get a confirmation of the evidence, because as we're talking about this, I'm sure people are shaking their heads and thinking, well, this is not true. I mean, this guy is pulling this out of his arse. And the first clip is from Sir Geoffrey Nice, QC, who is the leading leading prosecuting attorney to bringing the former Yugoslavian dictator Slobodan Milosevic to justice. And he conducted the China Tribunal in 2018 up to 2020. It's been conducting with the hearings and confirmed beyond a reasonable doubt that this is going on, that they have confirmed the allegations, him and the other esquires in the other clips I brought to you and your audience. And yeah, if you be so kind of play the clip, you'll hear the severity and the confirmation of this evidence come to light as we are speaking.
And here is that clip from Sir Geoffrey Nice.
People commit atrocities of limitless wickedness against other people in the course of international armed conflict, civil wars, and persecutions of people by their own governments. These atrocities are sometimes judged criminal by formal courts. In tonight's talk, Martin Elliott, former Gresham Professor of Physics and I sometimes Gresham Professor of Law, will discuss how an informal people's tribunal judged mass atrocity killings committed by the People's Republic of China, PRC, of thousands of its people, most notably imprisoned, peaceful, harmless, forbearing practitioners of Falun Gong, cutting open their bodies, sometimes before clinical death, to extract their organs, hearts, kidneys, and so on, for commercial transplantation into other people. And that process is known as forced organ harvesting. All kinds of mass atrocities are accompanied by other grave wrongs committed by people in power in the states involved in the killings of people involved in the states of other states of in other states that have self-interest to serve. People running international organizations such as the UN, and even material for our discussion by international associations of professionals, medics in this instance. And what are these wrongs? Lying about the truth of how and why the mass atrocities were committed, obscuring the truth, declining to face up to the truth.
Absolutely, once again, mind-numbing information, Mitchell, to hear Sir Geoffrey there talking about people being cut open before they are clinically dead.
Yeah, a new form of evil. This is a state-sanctioned kill-to-order transplant on demand. Basically, imagine yourself visiting a grotesque wet market restaurant. And we have them all around Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Basically, right now I'm in Vietnam, about 100 miles or 200 miles away from the Chinese border. Mm. And the lobster, you say, I want this, I want this, I want a lobster, I want a jellyfish, I want a squid. The cook goes into the back, takes it out of the tank, cuts it all open, and it's yours. The same thing is happening to the Falun Gong, the Uyghur Muslims, the House Christians, and the Tibetans, particularly the Falun Gong, the largest group of victims that have been just cut open while alive and their organs just taken out of their bodies. And 52 pieces of evidence confirmed that this is going on. And I think because we're pressed for time, why don't we go to the clip two, Chris? It's the Mattis Kilgore. Yes, okay. That's quite absolutely. Those are the two gentlemen, as well as they mentioned Ethan Gutman, who is the third investigative journalist and Nobel Peace Prize nominee, who confirmed the allegations as true in 2006. Give it a listen.
Alrighty. A rather upsetting issue, allegations that have repeatedly been aired that China plays a part in harvesting organs, mainly of executed prisoners. The numbers run to thousands every year. Organs then get sold on for transplants. It's always been vehemently denied by the Chinese government. But here in Britain, representatives of a campaign called Forced Organ Harvesting have been looking at the issue, and they've got as far as presenting their latest findings to the British Parliament. Two representatives join us here in the studio. Welcome to David Kilgore, former member of the Canadian Parliament, and Ethan Gutman, author of several books on China, who've both been involved in the investigations, are here to tell us a little bit more. David Kilgore, if I could start with you, what are the latest findings of your investigation? What are you closing in on?
That about 65,000 Falun Gong practitioners have been killed and their organs trafficked. There are other people too, convicted prisoners, are killed, of course, but, the thing that we're focusing on is the Falun Gong community. My colleague Ethan Gutman has done a lot of work on the Uyghur community. He'll probably want to say something about that, but yeah, there's no doubt. We have 52 kinds of evidence that this is happening. To give you the easiest example, the wife of a surgeon told us that her husband had removed the corneas from 2,000 Falun Gong practitioners in a 2-year period. So, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt in anybody's mind. We've got two books on it. We've got all kinds of.
And these, here. Just to clarify, these come after judicial executions.
No, there's no judicial involvement in virtually all of the Falun Gong. That's the thing that nobody understands.
Okay, right. So we better clarify this because we often cover the fact that China, of course, has one of the highest rates of execution, yeah. Judicial execution. It's their choice. That's what they do. And they're always there in the top three, along with Saudi Arabia and Iran. But this is something different.
Exactly. It's because a police signature is all you need to get sent to a forced labor camp. And then basically what happens is somebody from, it could be London, it could be Canada, goes over there for a liver. And there's a computer bank and it says there's a match for you out in camp number 50. And somebody's dragged out of camp number 50 into an operating room. Their liver's taken out of them. It's flown to Shanghai where you're probably waiting for your liver. And you come back to London with a new liver and somebody has been killed like a lobster in a grotesque restaurant.
Hang on a minute. So you're not even saying, because, I mean, it's one issue, the judicial executions and the use of the cadaver, which I suppose in a certain legal sense is the property of the state once the state has killed the individual. But you're saying these are people being killed to order.
Precisely. And it's so, as you say, your horror shows how distressing it is. But yet it never gets mentioned, that these are people who've been maybe giving out pamphlets asking them to stop killing Falun Gong and they're guilty of nothing.
The allegation and our findings are shocking. I mean, to us, this is a form of evil we have yet to see on this planet. This is a new form of evil. I'm David Madith, and with me is David Kilgore. We've been asked to investigate allegations that there has been harvesting of organs of Falun Gong in China. That the donors, the Falun Gong donors, are unwilling. Then they have been executed in the process, either for the purpose of the transplants or after the transplants, and that their bodies are cremated. That was the allegation we were asked to investigate. David Kilgore is a former member of Parliament and former cabinet minister for Asia Pacific, and I'm a Winnipeg lawyer doing immigration, refugee, and international human rights law in Winnipeg. We were asked to investigate this allegation by the coalition against the – well, it's a coalition investigating allegations of persecution, coalition to investigate the persecution of Falun Gong in China, which is based in Washington, D.C. We were asked to do this a couple months ago, and we have now done our investigation, and we're producing this report. We were not paid. We were doing this as volunteers, and we're not associated officially with anyone. We're just acting independently from everyone and doing this investigation. We pursued every investigative trail we could find. In the report, you will see that there are 18 different avenues of proof and disproof we considered and evaluated. Our bottom line conclusion after considering everything as best we could was that the allegations are true. We believe them to be true, that this harvesting is indeed happening. That conclusion comes not from any one of these different 18 categories of evidence that we looked at, but by assessing everything altogether. Altogether, they paint a whole picture. All the evidence we looked at either corroborated the allegations or, in some cases, where we were looking at possible disproof, did not disprove the allegations. We do know for a fact that the Falun Gong are depersonalized, dehumanized, and marginalized, repressed, persecuted, both in word and in deed, in the most vile ways possible. For this sort of allegation to be true in Canada would involve a very large step from where we are. But in China, it's not that big a step from where China has been.
Incredible, huh?
And that is absolutely incredible. Not just incredible, but like just soul-crushing to know that this kind of thing is absolutely going on, that this is not a theory. It's well beyond the point of theory. That is easily the third clip that you have provided to us of independent researchers going on their own dime to go research these quote nasty rumors that this is occurring in China, only to find out that it's no rumor, it's a fact.
Absolutely. And to add to your point, for 20 years, Chris, I mean, I started this crusade for no money, for no fame, no fortune. I come from a Judeo-Christian family, an American citizen, raised and born in South Africa, only because my family fled the Holocaust in 1940s, Nazi Germany. From Hungary and Ukraine and other places, which Lithuania, and I ended up, God willing, and as God intended, the Creator intended, in South Africa. And when I realized, and I've always been for the underdog, I've always cared about humanity, but when I realized that this was going on in China, something inside of me ignited, a deep flame of duty ignited my heart, my soul, my spirit, my passion. And I had to stand up. I had to go out and say, listen, I need to do something, God damn it. I need to alert ring the bells and the alarm bells and call to arms and beat the quarters and light the fires of Azeroth. You know, I am just saying, for 20 years now, my friend, I have been banging down the doors of every known human rights organization, think tanks, non-profit organization, multimedia corporation, and very few have come back and actually had the decency, the integrity, and the courage that you do, my dear sir. And Alex, we were talking about Alex as well, and Stu Peters, and I'm going on Steve Bannon. There are few and far between people who really will allow me to come on. But yeah, when the world comes to realize about this issue, particularly against the Falun Gong, where the entire Chinese economy, Chinese military, Chinese hospitalization system, the entire Communist Party system that is run by the Chinese Communist Party has declared war on this innocent group of spiritual movement and its practitioners, because it was integrated into Chinese society in such a way that was never seen before. 5,000 years of Chinese culture. This was the life force. Falun Gong became the largest group of Chinese citizens in all of history. One out of every Chinese national citizen. And this scared the living daylights out of the Chinese Communist Party. And instead of embracing it, they demonized it and declared war on it to eradicate and exterminate these people for the organs that they knew were good and healthy, but yet demonized them as some sinister evil cult to kill them for their organs. It's diabolical.
Well, and demonizing them, A, for their religious practice and belief.
Yes.
And in addition to that, because of that religious practice and belief, specifically focusing on them for the point of forced organ harvesting. So you're arresting them for the fact that they are practicing something that you as a government have said, you can't practice this, because it's not the state sanctioned religion. So you get to target them in that way. And then once you have them in prison, you get to turn them over to this monster that these reporters were just talking about that performed illegal corneal transplants on 2,000 people in 2 years. Now, just to give you folks a little idea, I've got my calculator here on my phone. I crunched some numbers while that clip was going on. That is just over 2 people per day, almost 3 people per day, that doctor was quite literally ripping the corneas out of because of their religious practice. 3 people a day died because of what they devoutly chose to believe and practice. And that's horrifying. That's that to me, as somebody who lives in the sanctity of your right to practice anything you want. That's disturbing to me. And the fact that China still sits on the human rights panel of the UN, the fact that even our good president has come out and said, like, well, you know, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on with the Uyghurs and things like that in China, but that's not really anything that we need to dip our fingers in, because, you know, that's just cultural differences, folks, between them and the Uyghurs and the Falun Gong practitioners. That's nothing for us to get involved with, right? Right, Mitchell?
Nothing to get wrong. It's just a cultural norm. Ethnic cleansing and genocide and torturing people for their organs is just a cultural norm, according to Steepy Joe.
Yeah, and that's what disturbed me more than anything, was hearing leaders of the free world say, like, that's just a cultural norm. When you're talking literally about a genocide.
Just give the troops some cookies.
Now,
don't worry, Jill, Dr. Jill, give the troops some cookies and then send them to the basement for a little steep, a cold basement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nothing to eat. These people are sick.
Well, go ahead.
These people.
Please rail off, because I think it is so utterly important for people to realize quite literally the complicity of the United States in this happening.
And I listen to all these hack multinational corporation and mainstream media, fake news conglomerates spew lies after lies after lies, complicit, intentional lies. And I think that we're all sheep because of these communist mouthpieces who have aligned with the CCP, who have aligned with these globalist pedophile scum. And QAnon, there's a deep state and there's a patriot state. But QAnon exposed these bastards. Even when Trump went on the town hall with Savannah Guthrie, I think, and she was talking about, well, do you believe in the satanic global pedophile ring? That they are right. They are. And look at what they've unleashed. And the perfect system of these globalists, okay, of the Rockefeller place, that led to the great famine where 40 to 50 million people died of starvation. The Bilderberg group, the Council of Foreign Relations, the royal families, George Soros, the Rothschilds. These people love and are obsessed with the Chinese Communist Party and the specter of communism, because it is the perfect system of terror to deceive innocent, law-abiding, free-loving people and make them into slaves slowly but surely and subtly, and to uproot and eradicate and weed out, disconnect and dismantle the consent of the governed and the ability to discern what is right and what is wrong. Destroy the nuclear family and take our God out of the churches, the schools and the courthouses, and make that normal, like they're normalizing pedophilia. This is all CCP tactics, communist-style tactics, cultural Marxism at its best.
Now,
pinning.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
If I may finish.
Yeah.
Pinning man against black against white, male against female, whatever you want to call it. And now they are going for and targeting the innocence and the purity of the children, because what these people do is that they feed off the innocence of the children. And again, this is not conspiracy theories, folks. This is conspiracy fact. I'm not here to waste your time, and I'm not going to have you waste my time and call me some kind of Mossad or CIA agent, which I am not.
Yeah.
But there are always going to be trolls. But what we're experiencing now is the greatest hoax, the greatest pandemic, and the greatest disaster we're about to face in all our lives. So get ready.
I was just about to say, but you using the word pandemic there was exactly what I was going to bring up. And this is not to say that coronavirus was released on purpose, anything like that. But is it to say that perhaps the Chinese government took full advantage of the fact that a leak occurred and allowed it to happen? Because if you recall, just before coronavirus happened, every bit of news coming out of China was how they were coming into Hong Kong and pulling people out of the street to take them to prison in China.
Yes.
Like, there was nothing but riots going on in Hong Kong against the Chinese government coming over the border, taking Hong Kong citizens and putting them into prison in China. That was every bit of the news. Go look it up. Feel free. While Mitchell talks here for a second, I'll be Googling it and showing you the articles. I remember having one of my good friends who is engaged to a lady in Hong Kong on the show talking about the riots going on. Talking about how there were areas of Hong Kong, like they were literally distributing maps to people out on the street, like, hey, don't go near this part of the city tomorrow because there's going to be a big protest in that part and the police are going to be over there. Avoid it. Don't go near there. You may be swept up amongst the madness.
Absolutely.
And then absolutely. Coronavirus hit. And the panic happened all over the world, and rightfully so. Horrible thing. I know people that have passed. I know people that have got sick. I have people in my family that have been sick. Even guests on this show have been sick. So is there a virus? Yes, absolutely. It exists. But was it something that was perhaps allowed to continue? Because if you recall, the virus happened and they did not shut down travel from or to China. When it happened, it was Chinese New Year, the largest travel day in the world, and they allowed it to happen. They allowed people to come into the country and to leave the country, and shortly thereafterward, world pandemic broke out, and you no longer heard about people getting dragged off to prison in China from Hong Kong.
Well,
the whole dialogue about China changed, and God bless them, you know, I mean, hey, call it a conspiracy if you want, but at least the dialogue about China changed, right? The dialogue about, hey, they're grabbing people off the streets and taking them to prison. It changed. The conversation totally changed. And so much so to the point that when the new president is elected, a year later, there's Joe Biden defending China on their human rights record. Dude, it was a year ago that China was literally, the government was dragging innocent people off the street in front of TV cameras. A year ago. And there's the headline out of the Irish Post, defending China on human rights record and accusations of genocide and torture, citing, quote, cultural differences.
No, it's sick. It's sick.
So, Chris. Yeah, like, is it an ongoing conspiracy to keep this under wraps, to keep it underground? Is it the fact that our government does nothing about it so that China can continue unabated that they can continue doing this and business as usual continues, you know?
I will share with you Dr. Li Mingyan.
Okay.
She is a virologist who worked in the top virology lab in the world for over 5 years. And her husband, also a top coronavirus expert, although now he's working with the Chinese Communist government. She's from China. She defected and exposed this. And her supervisors are all World Health Organization co-experts. And she can tell you that the lab to produce the virus was not only one type. This is an intentional creation of the bioweapon, intentionally to destroy, from her own words of mouth, from many doctors that have come out, actually. And there was a top defector, a counterintelligence agent, that also came out that talked about how the COVID-19 virus was a bioweapon, or is a bioweapon, that is intentionally made in the Wuhan lab. Even the Washington Post, the most mainstream of mainstream liberal newspapers that demonized people like myself and people who were talking about the Wuhan lab and calling it conspiracy and calling it and said that, oh, they debunked it.
Yeah.
Did a 180 and confirmed that it is now man-made, which is not natural, and has come from the Wuhan lab. And according to Dr. Li Mingyan, the Chinese Communist Party did this in order to destroy the Western world, to destroy the American people, and to take down the economic systems, and then take it over and install the communist-style system and have the globalists run the world. And this is what they wanted to do. And
yeah.
This is what their plan has been. And now they've administered a bioweapon kill shots disguised as vaccines. They're coming out with the vaccine passport, which is disguised as a CCP social credit score. So everything is coming out now. It's the choice of the individual to either believe it, to know, or not to know, and not to believe.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got the articles up on screen right now talking about the full-on 180 reversal, because we have held on this show with our guest, Dr. John Hall, this entire time that, hey, we aren't saying it was released as a weapon, but was it designed? Was it going through gain? Was this something that is the result of gain of function research? It certainly seems that way. Whether or not it was released on purpose is something totally different. But if an accidental leak happened and they did nothing and were complicit in covering that up so that the rest of this news would fade away, so that, hey, they provide most of the world's PPE, personal protective equipment, folks. Was it the fact of we were literally in the middle of a trade war against China and had locked down a lot of trade from China? And it was like, well, you know, if we let this kind of go, they're going to have to do nothing but trade with China.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's all roads lead to the Chinese Communist Party. It's the perfect diabolical system. Backed by the Rockefellers. They backed them at the Mao Zedong, like I said, when they came into power, from Marx and the Paris Commune and Europe into the Chinese civilization at the height of chaos after surrendered and left China and the imperialists, the Western imperialists, were organizing. And who do you think backed Mao Zedong, the Rockefeller? So they love the communist style system. A weak society of jolted youth in America and around the world, and they have done a tremendous job doing that. They're evil geniuses because, look, they've emasculated, they've pitted black and white together. I mean, if you just science and violence, they've radicalized the American youth into American communists, supporting radical groups like Black Lives Matter and Antifa. They've been able to instill fear and hatefulness and guilt into the American system, where once there was a loud and proud American flying American flags. Now American flags are banned and burned. Pledge of Allegiance are banned, and people who love the gods, guns, and country and flag, they're all demonized. There's no.
Yeah.
So this is the subtle decay of America through the infiltration of the Chinese Communist Party and its communist minions. But fear not, Chris, fear not, my dear ladies and gentlemen, my fellow human, because the return of the Jedi is imminent. Through Trump, I don't know. Trump's one man. I don't put my faith in only one man.
Yeah.
He's not God. I think it's a divine intervention, but I do believe he's a good man. He's been grossly misinformed in certain respects.
Sure.
And I think right now, after going through what he's gone through, he's a smart man. He's got a good heart. He's really getting his act together, because I think it wasn't his fault, but I think he was grossly led down a really dark path as well.
Yeah.
A bad path of misinformation and snakes and deep state operatives. I mean, look at Mike Pence. It has been confirmed by Lynn Wood that he is a pedophile. Mike Pence is basically Judas. He sold Jesus to the Romans. That's what he did. And you got a lovely gold pin from the Masonic order. Did you see that?
No.
Chris? Oh, you never saw the video.
Oh, hold on. I'm Googling it now.
Yeah. But it's when Mike Pence, the last time on the eve of the election results, he comes out and he says, "Yes, Donald Trump." Donald Trump lost the election because he was in Congress voting. I think it was like midnight or deep in the hours of morning, in the early morning. And as soon as he did that, before he walked off stage, there comes these rhino cons, these traitors. Because as we all know, as Ulysses S. Grant once said, that there are only two groups of people, and patriots. And as he sold Trump down the line and went and made his choice as a good little pedophile that he is, because obviously Lynn Wood has the videotapes and the video codes of Justice John Roberts and Mike Pence raping and murdering 15-year-old boys and 14-year-old boys. It's all on tape. He's got it. This is not something I'm pulling out of my arse, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure as hell I know it's conspiracy theory. Theorists. I've lived a long and prosperous life in the human rights and in hell to know about that. What is right and what is wrong? What is fake and what is not? And he sold out, Chris, and you can actually see these traders give him a gold, what it looked like a gold piece, shaking his hand and giving him a gold piece, and Pence looking at it and like at first regretting it, but then just going along with the deep state. So wow. There we go.
Wow. And, you know, once again, just to bring this rabbit hole back to the opening under the tree, it's really about weakening people. It's really about finding a means of control. And whenever you have things like this, whenever you have people like this with these proclivities in office, it's pretty easy to keep them under control and keep them under wraps and keep them following a paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you have something over them. Now you have that personal proclivity that is, of course, anathema in regular society. So whenever you have a chance to lord that over them, you have a chance to control the way they think, the way they act, what they do. And even to the extent of holding an office and saying, hey, you know, like we need to understand that what's going on over there is a cultural difference, folks. We need to understand that what's going on over there isn't exactly what we think. You know, like, I don't think you understand. It's a normal and a good thing that they're taking organs from people and giving them to other people, right? And that's something that was said in one of the clips that you provided, talking about how, hey, organ transplant is one of the greatest scientific feats ever known to man. Ever
in a legal way, not a forced way.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the doctor said was, you know, it. But this is not what we're supposed to be doing. This is not how organ transplant is supposed to happen. To take something from somebody without their permission, even if they have passed, mind you. Yes. There are laws against that here in the United States. Like, you can't just take a cadaver and remove their cartilage.
you have to sign a legal document saying that you are a donor, right?
Absolutely.
Like, I have it checked on the back of my driver's license that I'm a donor. Feel free to take my corneas if somebody can use them. I'm not going to use them.
Yes.
But without that piece of paper, and we ran into this even with my aunt whenever she passed of cancer many, many years ago, because we wanted a full autopsy to see, like, what could the proclivities within the family line be, you know, as far as cancer and all that kind of stuff. Any genetic research we could get would be great. But she was not a donor. She couldn't go through all of that because it wasn't in her legal paperwork to be able to do that. You know, so we couldn't order an autopsy. We couldn't do all of that kind of stuff because her legal documentation didn't allow for that. So we have legal means here in the United States to donate organs, to donate stuff, things like that. And hey, you can't even, like, donate your body to science and sell it preemptively, you know? We're like, hey, yeah, you know, I could sell my liver for $20,000 while I'm 24 and they'll come take it when I'm dead. Nope, can't do that. But apparently in China, they can fully take your liver and sell it while you're alive.
Absolutely. I wonder if you, since we haven't got much time left, I think it's quite a telling clip from the European Parliament. And he is a former vice president of the European Parliament 3 years. And he's Sir Edward Bermillon-Scott and talking about the forced organ harvesting.
Okay. And which clip was that?
That is clip 3.
Edward McMillan. Okay. Here we go with that clip right now, folks.
I wrote a report on EU-China relations in 1996-7 for the Foreign Affairs Committee. And returned to Beijing in 2006, where I met ex-prisoners of conscience, Falun Gong practitioners, as well as made contact with a number of other dissidents and reformers. All the Chinese with whom I had contact were then imprisoned, and in some cases, like Gao Zhisheng, tortured. Gao Zhisheng is a Christian human rights lawyer, very, very well known in China, who investigated the persecution of Falun Gong and wrote reports about it. One of the people I met, Cao Dong, who had been in prison, told me the story about how his best friend had disappeared one evening from the cell in their prison, and the next time he saw him, it was his body in the prison hospital with holes where body parts had been extracted. The belief that I have, and I share with David Kilgour, that organ harvesting is widespread in China, and it is restricted almost exclusively to Falun Gong practitioners. The only prisoners in China who are routinely blood tested and blood pressure tested are Falun Gong practitioners. The organ transplant industry is in the hands of the military. The People's Liberation Army is responsible for the hospitals, the transportation of body parts, and the sale of them. It is therefore a governmental activity and constitutes genocide under Article 2 of the Genocide Convention. It is as serious as that. The Falun Gong are to the Chinese regime of today what the Jews were to the Nazis during the war. And we should all take note of this and look at China with new eyes. The European Parliament comes from a very diverse background, and as Peter has already said, even within this quite straightforward resolution, there are still problems, because the absolute deluge of propaganda from the regime in Beijing vilifying Falun Gong as some sort of extremist cult. Now, I've met, as I said, hundreds of members of Falun Gong. It is not a sect. It is not a cult. There is no money involved. There is no brainwashing. All the normal characteristics of a cult simply don't exist. These are people who practice their spiritual exercises on their own. And yet, as I said, because between 70 and 100 million people in 1999 were practicing Falun Gong, this was seen by Jiang Zemin, then the leader of the Communist Party, as a threat to his own position. It wasn't, of course. but he saw the opportunity of creating an enemy within. Just as during the war, the Nazis singled out the Jews as a special characteristic and did what they did to the Jews. The same is happening today to Falun Gong in China. That is why it is genocide. That's why I say it's so serious. More than two-thirds of the prisoners in China in re-education through labor or forced labor camps are Falun Gong practitioners. That is a huge number of people. Now, at the end of the Kilgometis report, you will see a list of more than 3,000 Falun Gong practitioners who have died under torture. To the regime, those are wasted people, but nevertheless, they have died under torture in the prison camps. I've met hundreds of Falun Gong who have been through this terrible process of escalating torture. I believe that we should, in Europe, now set up something like happened in West Germany during the Cold War at Salzgitter, where an impunity index was maintained of confidential denunciations from East Germany under communist rule against torture and maltreatment. And after reunification, a number of prosecutions followed of those people. And what we need in the world today is an impunity index maintained at an international level, in my view, by the EU in conjunction with the International Criminal Court, so that people in China or other countries where there's repression may make confidential denunciations, and having talked to ex-prisoners, they tell me that the one thing that gave them some hope was that one day the torturers would be brought to account. Now, in the report of David Kilgore, David Matus, those 3,000 Falun Gong practitioners who've died, in those cases, it has been established where they were arrested, where they were imprisoned, who did the torture. That is listed, and that's a fundamental point. And we should never, ever give up on the idea that one day justice will be done. Thank you.
There we are, folks. There you are, Chris.
Yeah, like he just said, never giving up hope on the fact that one day justice will be done. Because once again, our government here in the United States is definitely complicit, at the least complicit. We know about it. It's there. We've heard about it. So why are we doing nothing against it? Why are we doing nothing to petition getting China out of the UN peace, the UN Human Rights Panel? What can people do, Mitchell? This is such a, once again, mind-numbing topic that the umbrella of it is so entirely huge. What can people as an individual do? What can we as people do to bring more awareness to this? What can we do to let our politicians know about this?
I think the most important, Chris, is to go to the websites and read the reports and find out more about what Falun Gong is and what the CCP is all about. And I think the best way to do that is to go to falunginfo.net, falunginfo.net. Stressed out. They are really frustrated, angered, stressed out, a lot of anxiety in these times. And I would try the exercises. They're free of charge. They don't interfere with your religion or your God. They're really beautiful and attractive, and their qualities are even more attractive: truthfulness, compassion, tolerance. So free of charge, check them out. And the exercises are free. You just learn them in the park, and very, very powerful and profound spiritual movement. And StopOrganHarvesting.org is a site that I and share as a person who's been on the front lines for 20 years. It's not my site, but I share and recommend it to people. And so StopOrganHarvesting.org, you can sign a petition, you can watch the video in and clear sight, very user-friendly, as well as EndTransplantAbuse.org, EndTransplantAbuse.org. All the reports are there, free of charge for all the investigators, and the videos as well. I would also highly recommend people watch a documentary, the award-winning documentary called Hard to Believe. It's won 18 awards, especially the prestigious documentary award of the Peabody Award.
Yep.
I live in Europe. And it's called Hard to Believe. It's free. You just have to go to YouTube and click or type in to YouTube Hard to Believe, free of charge. And it was released for people to learn. And for those of avid readers who love to learn more about the inside and the depths of the CCP and the communist specter and how the specter is ruling our world, a great editorial series out of New York from the profound and prestigious newspaper right now that is really taking the world by storm, the Epoch Times. The Epoch Times has the most amazing insight into the Chinese Communist Party that has pierced the veil of the CCP and basically has destroyed its lies and brought it out of the darkness. This particular group of people who had created this editorial newspaper were survivors from the Communist Party's brutality and fled China into America. On a call with one of the chief editors of the Chinese version of the Epoch Times, whose entire team was arrested and almost killed, and a lot of them were killed. My friends have been killed in China and sent to labor camps. I've never heard from them again.
Wow.
And she was managed in the ranks in New York of Chinese Falun Gong practitioners, immigrants and refugees, to create this incredible newspaper and editorial series, The Nine Commentaries on the Communist Party. But if you just go to Google, it's still, Google is working tirelessly with the Chinese Communist Party. And so I'm not sure how long it's going to be on Google. If anything, just type into DuckDuckGo. That's basically pierces the firewall of Google, which is really heavily censoring things. The editorial is called, or the publication is called, The Communist Specter is Ruling Our World. The Communist Specter is Ruling Our World, from the Epoch Times. And I guess that's it, Chris. I'm grateful to be on your show. And well, I'd love to come on one day again.
Oh, again and again and again and again. Like I said before the show, like I said in your last appearance, and like I'll say this time, as we morph into Curious Realm, I want to hammer this home. Like, I want to have you on at least every couple months to bring this topic up and to bring up updates on it and to really bring this topic to light, man. It's out there. It's horrifying. You know, it's one of those, like, I remember when we went to take care of Slobodan Milosevic. That is one of those horrible genocides that happened in my lifetime. I'm 45 years old, but I'm old enough to remember that. I'm old enough to remember, the tank man from Tiananmen Square, who held back a column of tanks. Not just one tank like the picture showed, but a column of tanks. One man, and that's what we have to do. We have to have that gentleman's mentality of not me, not here, not now. I will not stand for it. Fantastic if the whole world stands for it. Horrible for them. I will not. And that's where I'm at with it. That's where I've come down to just since having you on and this being your third appearance of who knows how many in the future. I cannot wait to talk about this more. I cannot wait for you to possibly bring on these UN doctors one day. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to come on our show and talk about it and expose our audience to this fact. One last time before we let you go. Because you are, of course, on Vietnam time, and this is a half a world away, quite literally. Give us those websites one more time before we let you go real quick. Mitchell, thank you so much again for the time, for the effort, and for your dogged pursuit and unwavering faith in this topic.
With pleasure. The first website for you to learn more about the Falun Gong atrocity. It's a new evil form of evil, folks. And if you think it's got nothing to do with you, think again. Just imagine it was your families that were ripped apart, torn apart, and never heard from again in the middle of the night or the midday sun, out of your businesses, out of your schools, out of your supermarkets, out of your own homes, and sent to state mandated hospitals and killed for kill to order to fuel money in a, yeah. in a business. Wouldn't you want to do something about it? Number one. Number two, with this bioweapon being released, these lockdowns, where do you think that has all come from? The CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. So fallinginfo.net, take a look at it. You can also learn about the exercises. Fallinginfo.net, stoporganharvesting.org, endtransplantabuse.org, and the Epoch Times, the communist specter is ruling our world. And the video is called, the documentary, the award-winning documentary, is Hard to Believe, Hard to Believe documentary, and just type that into YouTube. And yes, Chris, keep on fighting. It's been an honor. And I always leave you with, you know, I leave people with, to fail to support the good and to fail to expose evil is unacceptable, because what is a man who can't make the world a better place?
That's right. That's right. It really does fall to us, as we said earlier, less than 20% of the American populace took place in the American Revolution, folks. The other 80% of people sat back and went, look at these wackos. Look at these people that are trying to take on the British government, the largest army and most powerful navy ever seen at that point. Yet still less than 20%. That is one out of five, everybody. That's less than one out of five people. If you can change the paradigm of one out of five people around you, we can change the world. We can bring this topic to light. We can bring the hammer down on these people. Like you said, imagine if one of your family members was taken. Imagine this, folks, the bigger odd on favorite. Imagine one of your family members got one of these transplants. Imagine the cornea that your grandfather got a year ago came from somebody who was forced to give up their cornea. That's what you need to imagine. That every time somebody goes to get an organ, the chances are it could be coming from this source. And that's horrifying.
Absolutely.
That's scary. That's what we need to bring to light, everybody. So once again, Mitchell, I cannot thank you enough for your time. I cannot thank you enough for your mission and everything that you're doing. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing this with us again.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
Well, absolutely. And everybody, while you were online checking all of that out, Mitchell, please do hold the line. Make sure to stop on by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is, of course, our source for CBD. We ask you to make them your source for CBD. I use True Hemp Science. I found them years ago here in Austin. They are fantastic. Makers of some of the best CBD product out there. Spigeric process, 100% of the plant used. Absolutely great. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Dude7 is the code that you want to use there for everything. While you're online checking that out, please do make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast, dudesandbeer.com. Make sure to stop on by our sister site, our soon-to-be transformed name and identity, Curious Realm. Cannot wait for that to happen. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and if you can't be good at it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, drink responsibly.